dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, and WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Tonight we're going to look at how corporate greed and government corruption have been working hand in hand to suppress solutions to our worldwide environmental problems. For decades, some have attempted to sound the warning that we need to change the way we do things. Every industrialized country but ours is taking the threat seriously. Our government has collaborated with the petrochemical industries to make sure that nothing will affect the profit margins of these corporations, and the rest of us be damned. In our first hour, we'll look at global warming, and then hear from a British scientist whose research indicates that mad cow disease is related to environmental toxicity. Then we'll look at the contamination of milk and other food products and the fight to stop the plantings of genetically modified crops in New York. We'll conclude with a talk on environmental justice and the politics of pollution. Journalist Ross Gelbspan is the author of The Heat Is On. He has tracked global climate change even before it became a hot topic. Last month, he spoke at Harvard University about the solutions to the global climate crisis.
I want to draw our focus back now and try to look at the impacts on the whole global culture. And I'd like to start with a very interesting study that was in the journal Science in January. A couple of scientists re-examined a number of ancient civilizations that were thought to have collapsed from social and economic strife. These were societies and civilizations in South Asia, in the Middle East, and in South America. And it turned out on re-examination that those societies actually collapsed from sudden and unexpected changes in the climate, many of which were far less extreme than what we will be encountering in the next few decades. If those cultures were like ours, I suppose the message would be very simple. We are not immune to nature, and we're not exempt from history. But there is one difference between those cultures and ours, and that's this. They didn't know the culture was about to, the climate was about to change. But I'm a journalist. I'm not a historian. I'm not an environmentalist. And to me, today's news is not the climate shapes history. Today's news is that the heating of the atmosphere has propelled our climate into a new state of instability. Unintentionally, we have set in motion massive systems of the planet with huge amounts of inertia that have basically kept this planet hospitable to organized civilization. We have reversed the carbon cycle by about 400,000 years. We have changed the timing of the seasons. We have heated the deep oceans. We have loosed a wave of violent and chaotic weather, and the evidence is everywhere around us. From my perspective as a journalist, basically, the climate crisis clusters together three issues of enormous scope and pervasive impact. There is its natural dimension, its energy dimension, and its economic dimension. Its natural dimension is truly of cosmic proportions. The 11 hottest years on record have happened since 1983. The five hottest consecutive years were 91 through 95. 98 just replaced 97 as the hottest year. Scientists determined recently that the decade of the 90s was the hottest, at least in the last millennium, and the planet is heating faster than at any time in the last 10,000 years. Its energy dimension is staggering to contemplate. To allow our climate to restabilize basically requires nothing less than rewiring the entire globe and replacing every oil-burning furnace, every coal-burning generating plant, every gas-burning car with high efficiency, and renewable non-carbon energy sources. Our fossil fuels have brought us to a level of prosperity that was unimaginable a century ago. Today they are propelling us forward into a century of disintegration. The final dimension here, the economic dimension, basically centers around this widening global fault line that threatens to split humanity irreparably between rich and poor. And the impact of this global economic inequality on the climate has nothing to do with ethics or morality or justice. It has to do with a real simple fact. If we in the US and Europe and Australia and Canada and Japan were to cut our emissions dramatically, those cuts would be overwhelmed by the coming pulse of carbon from India and China and Mexico and Brazil and all those countries that are struggling to stay ahead of the undertow of chronic poverty. We simply cannot deal with the climate crisis without dealing with the crisis of global economic inequity. Today, as you know, governments are trying to ratify emissions reductions of 6% and 7%. A much larger reality is being ignored. The science is unambiguous. To return to climate stabilization requires cuts of about 70%. And that is a challenge of the magnitude I don't think we have ever faced before. I'm not going to go through the science. If there are questions about it, we can take them later. But the facts underneath the science are real simple. Carbon dioxide in the atmosphere traps in heat. For 10,000 years, we had the same amount, 280 parts per million, until about 100 years ago when we began to industrialize with fossil fuels. That 280 is now up to 360. That is a level not seen in 420,000 years. It will double to 560 later in this century. That correlates with an increase in the average global temperature of about 4 to 10 degrees. And to put that in context, the last ice age was about 5 to 9 degrees colder than our current climate. Each year, we're pumping about 7 billion tons of carbon into an atmosphere whose upper extent is about 10 miles overhead. The first consequence of the very small warming that we've seen so far is basically a forcing of the planet's hydrological cycle. And that's expressing itself in altered drought and rainfall patterns, in more severe storms, in more heat waves, in more protracted droughts, and in the fact that we're getting much more of our rain and snow in these intense, severe downpours. And the physics is real simple. A warmer atmosphere accelerates the evaporation of the surface water. It expands the air to hold more water. So when the normal turbulence comes through, we get much more of our rain and snow in these intense, severe dumps. The most direct evidence of this is the escalating succession of extreme weather events that have been battering the planet for the last few years. I just want to give you a few highlights from last year, the year 2000. And bear in mind, this is anecdotal evidence. It's not scientific, but I think it's very important. Last year, we had a one-day 15-inch snowstorm in Israel, the worst flood in more than half a century that left hundreds of thousands of people homeless in southern Africa. There were summer heat spikes that buckled freeway surfaces in San Francisco and melted roads in Turkey. They had to cancel a concert in Central Park because of mosquitoes infected with West Nile virus. You remember more than 64,000 drought-driven wildfires in the West that consumed millions of acres. There was flooding in India that left 4.5 million people homeless. There was a record 84-day drought in North Texas that cost farmers their $600 million. There was a very fertile area in northern China that they found is turning into desert. And in Britain, they had the heaviest rainfall and the worst flooding since they began keeping records 273 years ago. And what is significant about these anecdotal events is that that is precisely the pattern of weather that the computer models project as the consequence of early stage global warming. Economically, the costs of an unstable climate are visible in the escalating disaster relief costs of government. And you can see them in the rising losses to the world's insurers, the world's property insurers. In the 80s, the insurance industry lost an average of $2 billion a year to extreme weather. In the 90s, they lost an average of $12 billion a year. In 1998, they lost $89 billion, which is more than they lost for the entire decade of the 80s. And the head of the Reinsurance Association of America has said that unless something is done to stabilize the climate, it could very well bankrupt the entire industry. In case we're not particularly in love with the insurance industry, there have been some studies out recently about impacts on other sectors. There was a report out in November by the largest insurer in Britain, which said that unchecked, the impacts of climate change could bankrupt the entire global economy by the year 2065. And Munich Reinsurance put out a report last month that estimated costs in a couple of decades of climate impacts of $300 billion a year. Politically, there is a very strong totalitarian threat to climate change, and this is easiest to see in many poor countries where their ecosystems are as fragile as their traditions of democracy. Climate impacts hit poor countries hardest, not because the climate discriminates, but because they have the least developed infrastructures and least adequate ways of responding to these problems. And it is not unreasonable to foresee governments resorting to permanent states of martial law in the face of floods and droughts and food shortages and epidemics of disease, and especially of incursions of environmental refugees. There was an interesting story on the wires about 2 years ago. Papua New Guinea had a very long spell of bizarre weather, drought and frost. And after 4 months of this weather, 700,000 people left their homes. They began wandering the countryside in search of food and water. The government threw up its hands and said, "We can't deal with this." Fortunately, Australia and some other countries came to their aid, but it's an illustration of what I'm talking about. I think an increasingly unstable climate has very anti-democratic potentials for the countries of the North as well. It will cause big job loss. It will shrink foreign markets. It will impair the flow of industrial commodities from abroad. This is not the kind of climate in which democracy flourishes. This is the kind of climate that gives rise to food shortages with its associated black market crime. It can lead to the militarization of disaster relief personnel. And it is a fact that the CIA right now is studying the potential for political disruption from climate-related upheavals. I want to go through one more quick body of evidence here of what's happening to the planet. And this is a body of evidence that has nothing to do with data analysis or weather or computer models. These are warming-driven impacts that are happening right now. Heat expands water. Officials are right now relocating 40,000 people from a small group of islands off New Guinea whose lands are going under from rising seas. Last year, the Prime Minister of New Zealand offered to take in the populations of two other islands whose homelands are going under. Heat alters ecosystems. In the last 2 decades, the surface waters of the eastern Pacific off of California have warmed by 3 degrees. This is independent of El Nino events. This has killed off 70% of the zooplankton, the tiny marine organisms at the bottom of the food chain, and is threatening the survival of a number of species of fish and birds. Off Monterey Bay, scientists have documented a virtual complete turnover of the marine population as cold water fish has moved north and warm water fish and sea animals have moved in to populate the area. As ocean warming is driving fish north, atmospheric warming has propelled whole populations of butterflies from the mountains of Mexico to the hills of Vancouver. High above the oceans, most of the glaciers are melting at accelerating rates. The biggest glacier in the Andes 20 years ago was shrinking by 14 feet a year. Today it is retreating by 99 feet a year. The biggest glacier in Europe, which is in Iceland, now is disintegrating and falling into the North Atlantic, and the biggest glacier on the planet, which is in Greenland, the Greenland Ice Sheet, has since 1993 been losing 2 cubic miles of ice each year. Warming has also been detected, and recently a lot of numbers put on it, in the deep oceans. And that's doing a number of things. It is basically what the scientists found is that the oceans act as temporary storage mechanisms of heat. They then release this heat in pulses, which cause new spikes of heating, and that probably is expressing itself in El Niños. The El Niño patterns have changed dramatically since the 70s. The El Niño before the last one, the El Niño that ended in 95, lasted for 5 years and 8 months. That is a 1-in-2,000-year event. And the El Niño that followed it and ended 2 years ago was the most severe on record. This deep ocean heating is also breaking up big pieces of Antarctic ice shelves. There was a piece the size of Connecticut that broke off in 95, and a piece 10 times the size of Manhattan that broke off last spring. The tundra in Alaska, and Alex was mentioning the tundra up in the area where he was talking about, that tundra for thousands of years has absorbed methane and carbon dioxide. It is now thawing and releasing those gases back into the atmosphere. And because of the buildup of CO2, we've actually changed the timing of the seasons. Spring is now arriving almost 2 weeks earlier in the Northern Hemisphere than it did 20 years ago. And if we just stop and think about that for a minute, what that means is we are changing the rhythms of nature by which we have lived our lives and planted our crops and written our poetry for 10,000 years. Finally, climatic instability is bad for human health. There was a report by the World Meteorological Organization a couple of months ago that projected a doubling of heat-related deaths in the next 20 years simply from heating. This will come from heat stroke and dehydration and other heat-related effects. But there are other more complex biological interactions also. Warming accelerates the breeding rates and the biting rates of mosquitoes. It accelerates the maturation of the pathogens they carry, and it allows insects to live longer at higher altitudes and higher latitudes than they did before. As a result, we are now seeing mosquitoes spread malaria and yellow fever and dengue to populations which have never before experienced them. At current rates of warming, scientists project a doubling of mosquito-borne diseases in the tropical regions later in the century and an increase by 100-fold in the temperate regions where we live. We have seen locally transmitted cases of malaria in Ohio and Pennsylvania and last summer in Long Island. And in this part of the country, in Boston, there has been a very marked increase in tick-borne Lyme disease, again, because, with the exception of this winter, of the lack of killing for us that kill off the ticks in winter. Let me take a moment to just put this in perspective, if I can. The deep oceans are warming, the tundra is thawing, the glaciers are melting, diseases are migrating, and the timing of the seasons have changed, and all this has happened from 1 degree of warming. By contrast, the IPCC in January projected that our temperatures will increase by up to 10 degrees in this century. So the consequences to our social existence are truly profound. And as Dr. James McCarthy, who's head of Working Group 2 of the IPCC, said to me, if this unstable climate we're now beginning to see had begun 150 years ago, the planet would never have been able to support its current population. So from my point of view, this is basically the central drama underlying the issue of global warming. It's the ability of this planet to support our civilization versus the survival of one of the largest commercial enterprises in history. The oil and coal industries together generate about $2 trillion a year in revenues. They support the economies of at least a dozen nations, and they have, until recently, with one exception, been ferocious in fighting attempts to address this problem. Let me give you some examples of what I'm talking about. Over the last 10 years, the fossil fuel lobby has mounted a very effective campaign of deception and disinformation, especially in the United States, designed to persuade policymakers and the public that this issue is stuck in uncertainty. That campaign, for the longest time, attacked the science and in some quarters continues to attack the science. It also has misrepresented the economics, and most recently it's been targeting the diplomatic foundations of the climate convention. And it has been extraordinarily successful in sowing and maintaining a drumbeat of doubt in the public mind. I'll give you three quick examples here. In 1991, Western Fuels, which is a $400 million coal operation, was very candid in its annual report. It said it was out to attack mainstream science. It enlisted three scientists who were skeptical about global warming, Fred Singer, Pat Michaels, and Bob Balling. And Western Fuels and a number of utilities then launched a public relations program that sent these scientists to different cities and towns for interviews with the local media. The strategy papers for that campaign are very telling. They say specifically it was designed to reposition global warming as theory rather than fact. And more specifically, it was designed to target older, less educated men and young, low-income women in districts that get their electricity from coal and preferably have a member on the House Energy Committee. They followed that with a $250,000 video that was got very, very wide exposure. It was shown all over the place. And the argument of the video was not that global warming isn't happening, but that it's good for us. And the main thrust of the argument of the video is that if we get more warming, we can grow more crops in the far north to help us feed an expanding population. And to an uninformed person, it sounds okay, but there are a couple of omissions from that video. The first one, as I sort of indicated, is the bugs. Because of all the systems of nature, one of the most sensitive to temperature changes is insects. And all the relevant scientists agree that as the temperature goes up, we're going to see a big explosion in the population of crop-destroying and disease-spreading insects. The other omission that I personally find more unconscionable is this. As the temperature goes up, it will have a devastating effect on food crops in the tropical regions where most of the world's poor and hungry people live. and a half degree increase in the temperature will cause a big drop off in the rice yields in Southeast Asia. It could cause a 20% decline in the wheat yield of India. The use of the skeptics became clear to me when they were compelled under oath to disclose how much money they got from their corporate sponsors. This is money they've never made public before. But in the last 2 years, attitudes have changed a lot. Today, virtually all the oil majors, with the exception of ExxonMobil, now acknowledge global warming is a very serious problem. Most are already investing in clean energy. BP is now the world's largest producer and seller of solar systems. Shell has created a $500 million company in renewable energy. Texaco has been putting big bucks into fuel cells. And William Clay Ford recently declared an end to the 100-year reign of the internal combustion engine. But this disinformation goes on thanks to ExxonMobil. In a recent ad on the op-ed page of the New York Times, ExxonMobil declared the science is still unsettled and that people who cite scientific concerns about the climate are indulging in empty rhetoric. ExxonMobil's CEO, Lee Raymond, is fond of citing a study done by an Oregon chemist with no background in climate science that disputes the findings of the 2000 scientists of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. This chemist has declared that the ozone depletion is a hoax, that it's safe to drink the water irradiated by Chernobyl, and he happens to sell a homeschooling kit for people who are concerned about socialism in their schools. His study, which is a laughingstock of the scientific community, was publicly denounced by the National Academy of Sciences a couple of years ago, but this is what the CEO of Exxon is showing his shareholders to persuade them that global warming is a non-event. Finally, it turns out that global warming has emerged and replaced the oil companies and the Global Climate Coalition that Krishna mentioned as the major funder of this tiny handful of greenhouse skeptics. We have an article coming out in The Nation that will document that in a couple of weeks. You would never know this from global warming, but there's actually a solution to the climate crisis. And I think there is a way in which we can begin to pacify the climate and heal the human economic environment at the same time. I want to go through three very simple strategies that a group of us came up with, and we think this can get this started in a very positive way. They involve changing subsidy policies, they involve doing away with emissions trading and have a progressively more stringent efficiency standard, and they involve creating a large $300 billion a year fund to transfer these technologies to developing countries. Virtually all poor countries would love to go solar. Virtually none of them can afford it. On the subsidy issue, the U.S. government today spends $20 billion every year subsidizing fossil fuels. Globally, that figure is estimated at $300 billion. We're saying take the money away from fossil fuels, put it behind renewables, use some of it to retrain the nation's 70,000 coal miners, but the bulk of that money will create an incentive for the oil companies to retrain their workers and retool to become aggressive developers of wind farms and solar systems and fuel cells and so forth. Secondly, I think we need to substitute a progressive efficiency standard for this mechanism of emissions trading. Emissions trading can work nationally, internationally it totally breaks down, it's not monitorable, it's not enforceable, it is a source of huge equity contentions between the nations of the North and South, and ultimately we can't finesse nature with accounting tricks. And I think a much more realistic and equitable way of doing it would be to have every country start at their own baseline right now, raise their fossil fuel efficiency by, say, 5% every year, and that would do a couple of things. It would first bypass the equity problem, but more importantly, countries would reach that progressive standard by getting more and more of their energy from renewable sources. That would create the mass markets that would bring down the prices of these technologies and make them economically competitive. The final element of the plan that we're talking about is basically development of a fund of several $100 billion a year to finance the transfer of this technology to poor countries. One source that we like is an obscure tax known as a Tobin tax, which is a tax on international currency transactions. I think the easiest way to think about it is every time you sold or bought a share of stock, you paid a very small tax on it. But instead of taxing stock sales, we're taxing currency transactions. And when this James Tobin, this economist who proposed this tax 20 years ago, When he proposed it, I think the commerce in these currency transactions was several hundred billion dollars a year. Today, they amount to $1.5 trillion every day. And were we to tax them at the rate of a quarter of a penny on a dollar, that would net up to about $300 billion a year for wind farms in India and solar assemblies in El Salvador and fuel cell plants for South Africa. What I'm talking about here is not a North-South giveaway plan. What I'm talking about is taking totally non-productive, speculative transactions away from the finance sector, putting them into the industrial sector, where they will create lots of jobs and be very, very productive, and more important, will create a huge incentive for the oil companies to chase this $300 billion a year market that's driven by this progressive efficiency standard. What I am talking about here is a critical investment in our own national security. The global climate envelops all of us. I think what we need is the kind of thinking that gave rise to the Marshall Plan after World War II, so that today, instead of a collection of dependent and impoverished allies in Europe, we have very robust trading partners. I think a plan of this scope and scale would create millions and millions of jobs all over the world, especially in the poor countries. It would raise living standards there without diminishing our own. It would expand the total wealth of the global economy, and I think ultimately it would lead to a much more prosperous and a much more peaceful world. But the time is very short. Scientists recently estimated that the world needs to be getting half its energy from non-carbon sources by the year 2018, or else we will see a quadrupling of carbon levels, and that is clearly catastrophic. BP and Shell and Texaco and a lot of other companies are poised for this move, the biggest of all companies in the industry, the third biggest corporation on the planet, continues to drag its heels, mislead investors, confuse the public, and subvert the work of more than 2,000 scientists. It is time for ExxonMobil to stop sabotaging truth with money. It is time for ExxonMobil to stop withholding from the rest of us the huge surge of jobs and wealth that would flow from an energy transition. It is time for ExxonMobil to stop undermining the efforts of 160 governments to form a climate treaty. It is time for ExxonMobil to begin to use its immense power and influence to mobilize the rest of the oil industry in this kind of an energy transition. I would like to add one more thing. I think if we were to undertake this kind of a program, which nature requires, it would lead to far more than a mere switch in our fuel sources. I think the very act of addressing the climate crisis in an appropriate scale would bring home to everybody on the planet the fact that this Earth has limits, and I think it would generate a whole new ethic of sustainability that would permeate all our other institutions and dynamics. Finally, in addition to changing our energy diet, I think there's one final change we need to make, and that is basically a change in our collective self-image. For all of our history, we have thought of ourselves as helpless children of nature, dependent on her whims for our shelter and our survival. Today, as we enter the 21st century, we are no longer children. Somewhere in the recent past, with the power of our technology and the growth of our population, we have become as powerful as any force of nature. And as we continue to deny that newfound power, we are putting our entire history at risk. So I think the time is here for all of us all over the world, and especially for ExxonMobil, to finally grow up. Thank you.
That was journalist Ross Gelbspan speaking at Harvard University last month. You can learn more about Gelbspan's work on the web at www.heatisonline.org. That's all one word. Heat is online. Thanks to Martin Volker of No U-Turn Radio for that tape. Mark Purdy is a British scientist who's done extensive research into the issues surrounding mad cow disease. He has uncovered scientific evidence that suggests that the cause of the disease that is plaguing Britain and instilling fear in the United States is far different than what the U.S. government and the USDA has been telling us. Dora Ruse and John Barkhausen of WGDR in Plainfield, Vermont, bring us a controversial interview which has important implications for the fight against the spread of mad cow disease.
There is a growing debate in Vermont over sheep and the potential for an increase in the spread of mad cow disease, a disease that has been linked in the press to the degenerative brain disease known as Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, or CJD. The disease, which has seen major outbreaks in Europe, particularly in Britain, has been blamed on the practice of feeding cows, feed which contains the meat of cows who had been infected by the disease. Mad cow disease has been said to come from a protein, known as a prion. Many scientists have argued that the transfer of this prion, through animals ingesting parts of infected animals in their feed, has spread the disease throughout animal populations in Europe and America. Yet there is increasing evidence that the scientific explanation offered by governments and scientists alike is incorrect. Mark Purdy, a British scientist, has been doing extensive research on the relationship between mad cow disease, organophosphates, and environmental conditions. His research has taken him throughout the world and led him to very different conclusions about the nature of mad cow disease and its causes. Purdy argues that mad cow disease is not a result of the consumption of infected tissue, but rather a combination of several factors, which include exposure to a specific organophosphate and abnormally high levels of magnesium, coupled with low levels of other antioxidizing metals such as copper in the environment. John Barkhausen interviewed Mark Purdy last week in the midst of the controversy over sheep flocks in Vermont, which were imported from Europe. Purdy's research suggests that the sheep may in fact pose little, if any, risk at all to sheep, cattle, and people in Vermont.
Through my involvement with cattle farming and, sadly, having brought in some cows into my farm, which developed BSE, which kind of got me fired up about what the original cause was of BSE, because I felt the government had got it totally wrong in this country. I mean, basically, BSE was blamed on the disease in the scrapie form, jumping from sheep into cows. Because basically it was practiced to sort of grind up the remains of sheep, cows, pigs, poultry, and then make it into this meat and bone meal, which was then fed back to cows. And it was suggested that this abnormal brain protein called the prion protein, which is reckoned to actually cause this disease, the kind of molecular shape gets twisted, if you like, and misfolded. And when this is fed to other cows, the disease then somehow passes on and develops in other cows. But basically, I couldn't swallow that one because it was very clear that quite a lot of us had never fed feed containing meat and bone meal, yet BSE emerged in cows. It was one good example just up the road here on Exmoor, where the government were running an experimental farm called Liscombe, where they were rearing beef and dairy animals on a purely grass and silage system, which meant that they didn't have any of the feed at all from birth, which contained this meat and bone meal. Yet they had BSE on this farm, which was sort of staggering. You know, it's ironic that it happened on the government's farm. Furthermore, the meat and bone meal that was blamed was sold all over the world to countries like Libya and Saudi Arabia, one or two South American countries, South Africa. A lot of third world countries had received thousands of tons of the British meat and bone meal, which was incriminated for the cause of BSE. Yet these countries haven't had a single case of BSE at all. Our government has told us that microdoses of this meat and bone meal were supposed to cause the disease. So how come the thousands of tons, I mean literally boatloads, went to Saudi Arabia? Right. How come the cows that ate this stuff over there haven't developed a single case of BSE at all? Well, I think it's really a very convenient scapegoat. It's like any modern disease that seems to emerge that can't be explained is automatically blamed on a sort of natural phenomena which no major vested interest can be held accountable for. You know, it's sort of, well, it's bucks at the end of the day, isn't it? Pounds, is it, in Britain? You know? A good example is there was a syndrome in Spain called the toxic oil syndrome, where basically thousands of people developed this bizarre paralysis. I think about 2,000 or 3,000 people actually died of this crippling neurodegenerative disease, and it was blamed on this cooking oil. But various researchers in the Spanish government quickly observed that whole towns that hadn't received this oil the alleged batch that was supposed to have caused it, developed this disease. And it was actually eventually isolated on a batch of organophosphate insecticides that had been used as trial on tomatoes and cucumbers in one nursery in Spain. And all the affected areas had received these tomatoes and cucumbers. Obviously, there were sort of mega bucks involved there should the chemical company that made the stuff have been held responsible. So it was much more convenient to blame it on some, you know, rather vague, sort of the vagaries of sort of some natural contaminant in olive oil, you know. We love to blame viruses. You know, cot death was sort of blamed invariably on, you know, a virus, on someone's genetic weakness, you know, where no one can get blamed. And I think this is what's happened with BSE, a very convenient, misappropriated scapegoat that was held responsible. Basically, as an organic farmer in 1984, which was 2 years after a compulsory measure had been sort of instigated by the government in this country, we were forced by law to pour this organophosphate insecticide, that's a chemical that has been derived from the military nerve gases. By law, we were supposed to actually pour it in an oil formulation from the base of the head along the back line of the cow. This had to be done twice a year with a chemical that was basically used at extremely high dose rate of 20 milligrams per kilogram body weight. This was unique to the rest of the world, the dose rate, because the other countries, the few other countries that used this chemical, were putting it on at 5 milligrams per kilogram body weight. That was for lice, and some countries did it, Ireland, for instance, did it for warbles. And they were killing their warbles because they eradicated warbles at that four times lower dose rate. In Britain, it started in 1982, and it perhaps explains how BSE emerged at the first cases officially in 1986. Interestingly, France has had a BSE epidemic, albeit a lot smaller. They started their warble fly campaign originally in the Brittany area only. Brittany was a trial area, and then they spread it right over the whole of France. BSE first emerged in the Brittany area, and it hung around there for about 7 years, and then eventually, just recently, it started to erupt all over France, which seems to follow as a sort of six-year delayed lag the warble fly eradication program where they use this pesticide. And the position in the UK is much the same, where we have the same pattern where the warble fly treatments were used in certain regions out of maybe 3 or 4 years running, as was the case. Those regions have by far the highest intensity of BSE, whereas in the regions like Scotland, where there wasn't a major problem with warble fly, there was virtually no BSE at all. So both the timing and the distribution seem to match the timing and the degree of usage and the dose rate of the warble fly liquid. There seems to be a direct correlation. And I sort of had great difficulty, obviously, with convincing government that there was mileage in this science, because the government had compelled the use of it. Obviously, they would be resist to the very last degree, you know, admitting any role of this warble fly chemical with the disease. So I wanted to have this chemical tested, basically, you know, do some laboratory research and perhaps expose this chemical to a particular brain protein, which is known as the prion protein, which actually gets deformed in the brains of animals or humans who've died of the spongiform disease. So eventually the government actually did do an experiment, but the result was negative. And when I came to see the actual protocol of this trial, in fact, they'd just done completely the wrong trial. They hadn't used the specific type of organophosphate that was being used on farms in the real world, because it was actually a thalamidophosphate, which is a combination of organophosphate and the thalamide, the thalidomide type of group of chemicals. Thalidomide is well known to deform the shape of proteins. as occurs in this disease. So is, in fact, organic phosphates well known to form the shake. So they didn't use the right chemical. They used a what's called a recombinant prion protein, which is a sort of artificial form of the prion protein, which has been sort of genetically engineered. And it doesn't actually contain the same amino acid sequence as is found in the real live protein in the brain. And furthermore, the particular sequence they used didn't have the particular target amino acid, which I felt was feasibly the target of the organophosphate. So it was a totally sort of duff experiment that they ran. And so as time went by, I raised money both from saving up myself and a few well wishers, and we did run the correct experiment at the Institute of Psychiatry in London. And this prion protein is actually in the diseased brain of spongiform disease. The prion protein is found to be altered in about four characteristic ways. This experiment, where we added the phosmet, which was the organophosphate used on farms, we added the phosmet to the living brain cell in a cell culture sort of dish. This experiment created three out of the four characteristic changes to this prion protein that are seen in the disease, which was a sort of mega finding. This was done in 1996, and basically there was just no response at all, even though I managed to get one or two newspapers to do small articles on it. No one really recognized the relevance of this. In a sense, this was showing that this organophosphate was potentially causing susceptibility to prion disease. But nonetheless, there was this other factor, a phenomenon known as protease resistant, which is where the protein actually modifies to the extent that it can't be sort of broken down in the brain when it's done its physiological job in the brain, and it can't be broken down. And this is, in fact, the main change to the prion protein. So I was a kind of a bit upset that it hadn't achieved that. But clearly, there was a sort of missing link here. Maybe I thought there was something else going on, as well as the organophosphate, as well as the genetic susceptibility factor. That was perhaps another factor that I hadn't yet sort of isolated.
Mark Purdy, a British scientist whose work on mad cow disease suggests an entirely different perspective on its causes, found that there was another factor. In addition to the exposure to organophosphates, which are responsible for the degeneration of the brain in infected animals, Purdy's research indicates that there is an environmental factor which explains the appearance of a degenerative disease like mad cow disease in isolated wild deer and elk populations.
So, to get around this one, I kind of went back to square one and designed this global, really exciting global journey, which was going to visit very isolated clusters of spongiform disease that have occurred around the world in tiny pockets and have occurred for sort of several years. And my first port of call was Colorado, up in a tiny area of the Rocky Mountains near to a place called Fort Collins and Estes Park. Was actually, as you probably all know, was experiencing this epidemic or long-term sort of dribble of an epidemic, if you like, where 7% of the deer and elk were going down with this spongiform disease, chronic wasting disease. But what intrigued me was, why was this only occurring in a tiny area of the Rocky Mountains and wasn't spreading to the neighboring deer populations? And this made me feel, just like seems to be the picture in all the other cluster areas, that it was something in the environment was responsible. And furthermore, they'd done slaughter programs in Colorado where they'd eradicated whole areas of the deer from enclosed in areas, I think the reservations. And they went through elaborate sort of exercises to sterilize the soil. And in one experiment, they actually bulldozed all the topsoil away, which was just bizarre. But every time they reintroduced fresh deer after a 3 or 4 year fallow period, 3 years after the reintroduction, the deer would go down with the disease again. And exactly the same has happened in Iceland, where these pockets, these certain valleys, are just riddled with scrapie. And it's been around for donkey's years. You would have thought that that if it's, you know, if the disease spreads horizontally in this way, that then you would, you know, be spreading like that. I mean, some people have theories that it spreads through saliva. But, I mean, it just seems ridiculous, because if you study any of these clusters of spongiform disease, it's not spreading in this sort of hyper-infectious way that we've all been misled into believe. Yes, there's just, at the moment in the world, there seems to be a total hysteria. Then I went to Iceland, where it occurs in sheep and certain valleys. I went to Calabria in Italy, where a tiny area, one hamlet in Calabria, has had 20 cases of CJD since 1995. And, you know, this was an intriguing study. I went to Slovakia, where CJD, area for area, runs at the highest incidence rate in the world in three villages. And I also went to Sardinia and Sicily, where scrapie has erupted since 1995 at unprecedented levels. So what I wanted to find was to analyze the soils, the water, the vegetation in all of these areas to see if I could find a common factor which might sort of present as the missing link in this whole sort of causal riddle. And when my analyses came back, you know, after I visited each country, it became overtly clear that one metal, manganese, was coming out at a sky-high reading, at a toxic level, in all of these environments, as was terribly low levels, rock-bottom levels of copper, selenium and zinc, in all of these areas. And in the disease-free areas adjoining that I tested, the levels of manganese invariably seemed to drop to normal. And the pattern was so clear-cut that you could virtually just go and test an area of the Rocky Mountains, and from that test, you could tell whether it was a chronic wasting disease area or not. It was so clear-cut, and I found precisely the same in Iceland. You could test a valley and then tell the vet whether there was scrapie there or not, and he would confirm that, invariably, that this was correct. This was just an amazing finding, what it seemed to me, I started studying manganese toxicity, and I found that miners of manganese, particularly before health and safety had improved in the mines, were going down with this bizarre, fatal, progressive, neuropsychodegenerative nervous disease. And when I looked at the pathology of this disease and the clinical symptoms of the disease, it was very clear that there were just so many parallels with CJD that you could almost say it was the same disease. The business of laughing death, you know, it was described that miners would just burst into a totally uncontrollable, unmotivated laughter. Whereas the death of this disease in Kuru in New Guinea, the spongiform disease, it's known as the laughing death. There were so many similarities. There were these amyloid fibrils in the brain of people who are dying of this manganese intoxication. It tended to happen to miners. Usually the clinical stage of the disease emerged about between 10 and 20 years after they first started working on the mine. So it was much like the spongiform disease. It was a delayed type of disease. And it appeared to me that manganese is well known to switch on this kind of chain reaction of free radical damage. Manganese actually sort of generates free radicals when it gets converted into a certain form. And a bit like a nuclear meltdown. So if you get a build-up of manganese in the brain, and that's the exact area in the body where it does accumulate in the brain, and then you get that when the manganese is actually oxidized, it's this sort of oxidizing effect on the manganese that converts the manganese into this lethal free radical chain-reacting form, which manifests as a sort of a nuclear meltdown, if you like, in the brain, which is causes these degenerative lesions which slowly spread and take over the whole brain and spinal cord. Because I also found in these areas low levels of copper, zinc and selenium. All of those metals are actually antioxidants. So from this sort of picture of a high oxidizing agent and then low antioxidants, it became very clear to me that this was a sort of free radical disease, basically. So I wrote a paper about this theory based on my field findings. I went to Cambridge University, where I proposed this study to a scientist called Dr. David Brown at Cambridge University. And David had actually discovered that the job of the prion protein in the brain, and he showed that prion protein normally in the healthy brain bonds onto copper, and that the two together, the copper and the prion protein, have a role in destroying free radicals. They in fact have an antioxidant effect. So this was very clear to me that in an environment where there was no copper, the prion protein would kind of be stripped of its copper and therefore would lose its function and perhaps might take up, bond onto another metal in the brain that was similar, and that would create an abnormal effect. And I hypothesized that manganese would bond on. So David Brown did an experiment in his laboratory where he exposed the prion protein in a living cell again to manganese. And lo and behold, he got exactly that. The manganese bonded to the vacant copper site. And then it produced this abnormal, this fourth characteristic that I didn't achieve with the organophosphate. He produced with manganese. So I then saw the whole picture. It was crystal clear that it's the oxidizing properties of the organophosphate that oxidize, interact with the manganese, produce the whole package of this bizarre degenerative disease process. In the modern form of this disease, BSE and new variant CGD, this is where the organophosphates, which are potent oxidizing agents that get into the central nervous system, this is what causes this more potent, accelerated version of the prion disease. But with the traditional forms of the disease, like the chronic wasting disease in Colorado, the scrapie in sheep in Iceland, what I found in Slovakia, what you've got there is manganese intoxication, but with a less potent oxidizing agent. And because this disease actually starts in the traditional form, in the retina, in the eye, it just was so obvious that it was the ultraviolet light, which is a milder oxidizing agent than organophosphates, was actually triggering off the disease with the manganese that is well recognized to accumulate in the retina, in the eye, as does the prion protein accumulate in the retina. So everything sort of came together. In a sense, the prion, because it's got copper there, normally, when we receive ultraviolet radiation in our eyes, the healthy eye can kind of deal with, both utilize it for its beneficial effects and for controlling kind of fertility and that sort of thing. But also it has this negative side effect of sort of generating free radicals that have to be kind of sponged up, scavenged. And because the prion protein seems to locate itself in areas where these environmental oxidants are coming in, i.e. in the retina, in the eye, which is receiving the ultraviolet radiation. It seems possible and likely that the prion protein, the copper attached to it, has its job is to sort of sponge the free radicals up that come in from the ultraviolet light. So when you kind of destroy the function of the prion protein by overloading it with manganese, then the brain, that the retina, isn't able to deal with this incoming assault from the free radicals which are generated by ultraviolet radiation. So the kind of whole system collapses, and that kicks off these free radical chain reactions which are able to proliferate and just get out of control and blitz their way through the whole brain tissue and cause the characteristic degenerative lesions that are found in this disease. Why were these diseases appearing, the traditional forms, that is, at high altitudes that are snow-covered for the majority of the year? You know, whenever I'd arrive at a new sponge form location, whether it was the Coffee Mountains in Japan, the High Tatra Mountains in Slovakia, the Rocky Mountains in that area of Colorado, there were all these same geographical features of these sort of high altitudes. And those areas are well known to experience much higher intensities of ultraviolet light naturally. And of course, with the thinning of the ozone that is supposedly going on now, we're getting more ultraviolet radiation coming through than normal. So it stands to reason that both, you know, the traditional form of these diseases are going to be increasing.
You've been listening to an interview with Mark Purdy, British scientist and researcher on mad cow disease. For Voices for Democracy, this is Dora Ruse and John Barkhausen.